Good afternoon and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host, and today we are discussing how leukemia was beaten with groundbreaking CAR T cell therapy. And our guest today is none other than Dr. Stephen A. Grubb, CAR T cell expert and director of cancer immunotherapy and cell therapy transplant section at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and University of Pennsylvania. We also have Tom Whitehead, father of Emily Whitehead, the first pediatric patient who was administered CAR T cell therapy with us on Cure Talks. On the panel are Gary Peterson and Jack Aiello, cancer advocates and myeloma survivors. So a very warm welcome to all. We will be addressing questions from the audience towards the end of the discussion. You can send in your questions to priya@trialx.com, or you can also post your questions in the comment section. So beginning with the discussion, Dr. Grubb, it's such a pleasure to have you here on Cure Talks, and you have saved Emily and the children who are enrolled in the CAR T trial, and I believe Emily is almost 6 years in remission. Dr. Grubb, do you think we are at the edge of a breakthrough in cancer treatment and a probable cure?
Well, thanks for having me on, and that's of course, a really important question. Are we looking at a cure here? And I think that you have to break that question down and think of it in pieces. And so everybody's heard a lot about immunotherapy as a new way to treat cancer, and immunotherapy is actually a whole lot of different things. This particular kind of immunotherapy called CAR T-cell therapy has been used in patients with blood cancer, and specifically with the most experience in the most common kind of cancer that kids get, which is called acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is a kind of blood cancer. And so for that group of patients, we have seen some amazing results, even in patients who have no other treatment options and no real hope for any kind of disease control, not to mention a cure. And with patients who are a number of years after that therapy remaining in remission, we are starting to hope that maybe that's a cure for some of those patients. But the broad question of whether this is a cure or not, I think that there are a lot of different kinds of cancer, that most cancers are not blood cancers, and this really changes the whole face of cancer care if we start to see these kind of dramatic results in patients who have other kinds of cancers like for example, lung cancer or breast cancer or pancreas cancer. And so that we haven't seen yet. So is it a cure? It may very well be for patients with a very specific kind of cancer. Is it something that's going to change the whole field of cancer therapy? That's the work of the next 5 years.
Absolutely. This certainly has given terminal patients a last chance. And I believe you have made many, many parents very, very thankful, Dr. Grubb. Tom, great to have you with us. I know you're driving down from New York City after attending the Time Gala, so thanks for joining us. And I want to congratulate you. Emily will be almost 6 years cancer-free on 10th May this year. So how do you feel?
Well, we feel very blessed, you know, to have Emily back to normal again when you see her with her friends. Now, if you didn't know what happened to her, you can't tell. She looks normal. And to parents, mm-hmm. that's what a cure looks like. So to have her now 6 years past the treatment and back to normal, the only medicine that she's on right now is the Hizentra, the immunoglobulin replacement, which we do every 2 weeks. So it's really just twice a month that she has to get medicine. And other than that, she's healthy and happy. And we couldn't be happier as far as our family goes. It was a miracle.
I totally identify. Oh, yes. I totally identify with that. I myself have two children, and I can understand how you're feeling. It must be really uplifting. So, Tom, you and Curry, your wife, started a foundation, the Emily Whitehead Foundation for Childhood Cancer. And I believe you recently donated $250,000 to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. So I would like you to talk a little bit about your foundation and activities for our audience.
Yeah, thank you. So In January of 2015, we decided to start the Emily Whitehead Foundation. We did notice a lot of people were using Emily's story to raise money, and a lot of that money wasn't going back to pediatrics. So our goal is to keep the attention on pediatrics and the focus on pediatrics and help fund it because it's so underfunded. And we've been very fortunate to have some really amazing volunteers help us. And, you know, to have given now Dr. Grupp $350,000 total. And we're also part of another grant of $250,000 that's going there to Dr. Barrett. It's pretty amazing for us. And, again, we want to specifically focus on the pediatric immunotherapy and make sure they have the funding to move it forward so other families can have the same outcome that we did.
That's great. We hope your foundation is able to help a lot of children out there, Tom. Dr. Grupp, Dr. Grupp, a lot of debate and discussion surrounding CAR T therapy has been around mostly two aspects, one being the severe side effects and the other being the cost, high cost of treatment. So we'd like to talk about this one by one. Can you talk a little bit about the severe cytokine release syndrome and how for Emily you found a rheumatoid arthritis drug as a remedy?
Sure. So I think it's important to understand both that therapy can be helpful and that can also have side effects. And I think it's important to understand that. I'm going to step away from that question for just 1 second and just follow up on Tom's point because I think it's so incredibly important. You know, we here at CHOP are incredibly grateful for the funding support that we've gotten from the Emily Whitehead Foundation. But I think Tom and I both strongly believe that even more important than the funding is the messaging. And the messaging is that the first CAR T-cell therapy in medical history was approved for children and young adults. And kids led the way, pediatrics led the way. It's very unusual, actually, to have a new therapy approved in kids, and especially as the first thing. And so we want to make sure that as the immunotherapy revolution continues, that, of course, the appropriate attention is paid to all of the very serious adult cancers that we hope that we can help, but we want to make sure that there's some attention paid to the pediatric side as well. So I wanted to jump in on that because I so strongly agree with Tom in that regard, and he and his the foundation and his family have really been leaders for this point of view. Now let me go back to the question you asked me, which was about side effects. So this therapy is basically a setup where we collect immune cells called T cells from each individual patient. We then genetically reprogram these cells so that they become cancer fighter cells, and then we put the cells back in the patient. And in situations where the patient has a relatively small amount of leukemia, the side effects that we see are very mild. A patient may or may not have a fever. They may not spend a short period of time in the hospital. They may stay out of the hospital altogether. They may have a short headache one afternoon. Really, almost nothing. But what we've also learned, and we learned this from Emily's case and from cases since her, is that patients who have a great deal of leukemia in their body can have a completely different experience. And so the great news for those patients is that we're also able to put them into remission with CAR T-cell therapy. But if you have a patient who has literally pounds of leukemia in their body, the T-cells, the engineered, the reprogrammed T-cells, have to grow to a very high level to attack all that cancer. And that's why this works. So if you have a little bit of cancer, your T-cells don't have to do very much. But if you have a lot of cancer, then the T-cells really have to get revved up to get on top of all that cancer. And it's nearly miraculous to us that we're actually able to see those kind of responses, even in patients with completely uncontrolled disease. Why do patients get sick? Why do they get this thing called cytokine release syndrome? Well, it happens because those T cells are part of your immune system, and your immune system gets incredibly revved up in the process of killing all that cancer. And so we really did have to learn how to control that reaction. And the first patient where we really recognized This reaction that at the time we didn't even have a name for it, but now we call it cytokine release syndrome. And when we really understood how severe this could be was in Emily Whitehead's case, because she fit that profile. She had very significant amounts of leukemia, and the T cells had to really get very revved up in order to control all of her disease. The reason that it is safe to do this, and the reason that Emily, after definitely a tough time in the intensive care unit at Children's Hospital Philadelphia, mm-hmm. the reason that she was able to pull through was what you mentioned. So we were doing all sorts of science in the background trying to figure out why Emily was as sick as she was. We were doing research tests to look at, without getting too technical about this, we were looking at all the things that happen when your immune system gets activated, including producing all these inflammatory proteins, which is how the immune system talks to each other. One particular protein was through the roof. It was incredibly high. Turns out, oddly enough, it's not even a protein that's made by T cells. It's made by other cells of your immune system. And that protein turned out to be the one that was making Emily sick. And the great news is that there just happened to be a drug that was developed for patients with rheumatoid arthritis. And Dr. Carl June, who's very involved in developing this therapy, his daughter actually has rheumatoid arthritis. And that drug, it's called tocilizumab, would never have heard of it as a cancer doctor before this. That drug specifically targets the abnormally high level of this inflammatory protein that was making Emily sick. And that observation and her experience getting better very rapidly after we treated this toxic side effect with this new medication that had never been used for this purpose ever has, I think, not only been transformative for this particular CAR T-cell therapy, but it's now the basis of all the toxicity management in CAR T-cell trials across the world.
And I understand this drug has since been approved by the FDA for treating CAR T-cell therapy-induced CRS.
Yes, and that's also a fascinating side story, because this is the company that makes the drug is not the company that mm-hmm. makes the CAR T cells. So Novartis makes the CAR T cells, and they don't make tocilizumab. But the Food and Drug Administration recognized that they were going to say, "Hey, you need to use this drug for this purpose." So they basically used data from the cell therapy trial to provide mm-hmm. an extra approval, and that, I think, is a highly innovative way to go about this. They didn't make the drug company do their own trials to show that it worked. We already had data that it worked. It was very clear data with dramatic responses like we saw in Emily's case, and they were happy to use that data. I think it was a great thing that the FDA did.
Yes, absolutely. So Tom, as Dr. Grupp was explaining that Emily had a severe episode of the CRS cytokine release syndrome, and I believe she was critically ill at one point. She was put on a ventilator and a coma was induced to keep her alive. How did you and Carrie hold up during this time? Must have been so, so very difficult. It would be great if you could share that. What kept you going?
Yeah, so, you know, we knew before entering the trial that Emily could not survive without it. So keeping the faith that that was our only chance and it had to work, I never looked at it as any other way than the end result would be that she would survive. But I can tell you that 14 days that she was on the ventilator were brutal. So, you know, we just kept talking in her ear, playing music to her. You know, but at some points it didn't even look like Emily anymore, but she just kept fighting. And when we would feel weak, she would give us a sign. And when we could, we relied on faith a lot. And we just stayed positive and said, there's no other outcome that's going to happen here. And she's going to wake up from this and be okay. And, you know, after the 14-day coma, she came back to us on her seventh birthday. But absolutely what Dr. Grupp said when he came through the door, it was looking very bleak to the point where the PICU team didn't think she could survive, and he suggested the tocilizumab, and once he gave it to her, everything turned around. Within 12 hours, things were turning around, and they were telling us in the intensive care unit that they had never seen a child that sick get better any faster. So you know, we had been waiting for what I say was our miracle, and then it finally came with that dose of medicine, and Emily turned around, and, you know, she woke up on her 7th birthday on May 2nd of 2012, and we went home on June 1st, and she's been cancer-free ever since.
So amazing to hear that. Dr. Grubb, what is the follow-up regimen of the therapy that these patients have to follow? Are there any precautions the children and parents have to keep in mind during recovery and going forward?
Well, so I think that you can sort of break this up into getting ready for the therapy, receiving the therapy, and then what does the long term look like? And so from a getting ready standpoint, we're working with the doctors at the hospital where the patient is treated to make sure that the patient gets, you know, an appropriate amount of leukemia therapy without being so intensively treated that they get sick from their prior therapy and we can never treat them. So that's one precaution that we take. During the month after the cells go in, we like to keep the patients close by, and we're treating patients from all over the country and actually all over the world. And so we do ask the families to stay in the Philadelphia area for 3 or 4 weeks after the cells go in. And so during that period, we're looking for cytokine release syndrome. That's our big thing. And it's easy to pick up because if you have a fever, that's the start. You can just stay with a fever, or you can get sicker like Emily did, and it depends very much on how uncontrolled your leukemia is. So most of these patients are admitted to the hospital for a short period of time, and 20-30% of them actually end up needing ICU-level care for a week or less. And so that is that sort of what happens right after you get the cells. Now, what's amazing to me, you know, these are kids. Underneath their cancer, they're still healthy. And so all you have to do with kids like this, and we saw this with Emily, is leave them alone. And you're not giving them treatment after treatment after treatment. You're not keeping them in the hospital all the time for high-dose chemotherapy. You're not causing them to get infections because their white cells and immune systems don't work anymore because of the chemotherapy. So they get better so fast. After that initial 3 to 4 week period where we're watching for potential side effects. And there, the precautions are minimal. I mean, we're pushing these kids, and of course the parents are pushing harder than we are, to get back to school as quick as possible. You know, we want to get them back to their lives. The one long-term side effect we absolutely do see, and I don't want to minimize this, is that the kind of leukemia that we're treating is related to normal cells in your body called B cells, and B cells produce antibodies, and antibodies are basically what vaccines make for you. And if you don't have normal B cells, you don't make antibodies, you don't have that vaccine-like protection, and you need to get a medication to replace that, which Emily and a lot of the patients do get. So if they get that medication, I think, and Tom can confirm this for me, I think that basically we don't see a lot of problems associated with that, and that's really the only long-term side effect that we've seen in these patients.
Mm-hmm. So Tom, as a parent, what are some of the precautions you keep in mind when she is probably off to school or to play?
Well, I think, you know, we look at her now as a normal child. It's just minus B cells. So as cancer parents, Carrie and I still panic inside if somebody's really sick around her. I mean, but I think anybody that sees somebody that has something contagious is going to try to keep their child away from them. But we don't have to limit whatever she wants to do, she can do, you know, minus being around somebody that's got a severe virus or whatever. But I think any parent would do that. So I can't say that, you know, now we still worry a lot as parents because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but she's a normal child.
Mm-hmm. So does she have a favorite game or sport that she likes to play?
Well, she's on her computer quite a bit now playing Sims, and she likes to do Minecraft. She has a lot of architectural skills for Minecraft.
Okay. That's nice to know. Dr. Grubb, moving on to the cost, as I was mentioning right at the beginning, and the high cost of CAR T cell treatment has been a shocker for many. At $480,000, the affordability of this treatment has come under a lot of fire. So it would be great to just hear your views on this.
Well, you know, that's a very important consideration. So, you know, obviously I'm a pediatrician at a hospital in Philadelphia. I'm not a drug company person. What the discussion about the price of CAR T cells has really brought forward in my own personal mind is medicine in America is incredibly expensive. Being in the hospital is expensive. Cancer drugs are expensive. The cost of this particular therapy, Kymriah, or it has another name which is nearly unpronounceable, which is Tisagenlecleucel, the cost of that is very comparable to a lot of the brand new cancer drugs that are available these days. And the reason why it is a little bit more striking, for sure, is that instead of being a therapy that you get every month and it costs you $20,000 a month, but you could be on it for years, this is a therapy you just get once. Emily got these cells once. And so the concept that for at least some of the patients, not all of them by any means, but a big fraction of the patients, this can be one and done. This is a one-time therapy. I mean, literally, although the side effects can be significant, as we've talked about, the administration of this therapy takes 2 minutes. You walk in the door with a syringe, you infuse it into the patient in a very short period of time, and that has the potential to be the last treatment the patient ever gets. And so from our perspective, you know, we worry about access. We want to know, will insurance companies pay for this? And in our experience, having given more commercial CAR T-cell product than any other hospital in the country right now, is that insurers do pay for this. So that's extremely important. If we can't get an insurance company to pay for it, then we can't give it to the patient, and that's a significant problem. So we want to make sure that the kids can actually get this. And then the issue of why medications in America are as expensive as they are, broadly speaking, that's a societal question I'm not really prepared to have a good answer for. But do I feel like in this particular instance, this therapy offers significant value to patients, not just a marginal increase in potential months of life, but potentially being a cure for a reasonable fraction of patients? I think it does offer significant value.
Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Grubb. We'll have a couple of questions on the therapy and the trial as such, and then we'll hand it over to the panel for some questions. So, Tom, I'll start with you. We want to know, where did you first hear of the CAR T trial, and what prompted you to make the final decision to enroll Emily in an experimental drug trial?
So we actually found the trial on our own. My wife, Carrie, works in research at the Penn State University, so she used her research skills to look at any available possible options, and it really made us happy that there was something available that's only 4 hours from our house. I know at one point I told Emily, if I have to crawl to the North Pole to get you better, I'll do that. But we did not get support from our local hospital on going to an experimental trial, but we did it on our own, and we trusted our instincts as parents. And transferring Emily down into Dr. Grupp's care was the best decision we've ever made. So when we, by the time we had transferred down, our options were take Emily home on hospice or go down, transfer down to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and try her as a first patient in a phase one trial. And we weren't ready to stop fighting, and Emily wasn't ready to stop fighting. So hospice wasn't an option for us. And I can tell you as a parent that deciding to join this trial for me was easier than trying to give Emily full body radiation to go to a bone marrow transplant, because that scared me more than this trial did. You know, worrying about doing permanent damage to her learning ability and everything with the radiation. And, you know, I think we were almost going to bone marrow transplant, and in the end, the CAR T treatment cost much less for our insurance than the T cell treatment did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for us, it was a life and death decision.
Yes. Dr. Grav, I know you talked a bit about how what the therapy entails, but as we are talking about children here, so does trials for children have any specific considerations that you have to make?
Oh yeah, there are definitely significant considerations that we have to make, and the most important one is that when we set up a clinical trial for kids, for especially a new medicine that's not been tried before, we really have to ask the question, do we think it might help? If we feel like that, they call this prospect for benefit. Do they feel like this might actually be helpful? There's no guarantee of success in anything that you do in life, but is there a reasonable chance that the child who is in front of you will benefit from the therapy that you're offering them? And if you can basically convince the Food and Drug Administration and the Ethics Review Board at your hospital that you have data that shows that there might be a hope for that individual child, then that's really when you can include patients in research. And obviously, for patients who have much less serious conditions, that's a pretty high bar to get over. But in patients who have cancer and no other treatment options, the bar becomes a little bit lower because, as Tom pointed out, for many of the patients that we treat, it's either this or care intended to make the patient comfortable in the last few weeks of their life. And so that's a very stark decision. That said, from my perspective, I'm a pediatric oncology researcher. I've been doing this for a long time, but facing a family like the Whiteheads and saying this is a brand new therapy, it's only been tried in a small handful of adults. Nobody has ever really treated cancer with something like this, exactly like this before. It's never been tried in a child before. It's never been tried in a patient with this kind of leukemia before. I mean, that's a lot of nevers. While we were very hopeful that it might provide some benefit for Emily and could not have done that without that, the courage involved of the family to get involved in this kind of research, I think, is also extremely important. So, yes, we have a special requirement in pediatrics that we feel like the research is worth doing.
Yes, I have one last question before I hand it over to Gary Peterson. CAR T cell is a living drug, and it's supposed to remain in the body for months and years fighting cancer. So apparently, in some patients, the T cells go away quickly. Dr. Grubb, do we know why this happens? And if the CAR T cells go away from the body, will the cancer recur?
So there are lots of pieces to this. So let me try to sort of take that apart a little bit. So the answer is that with this particular CAR T cell therapy, the recipe seems to be that the vast majority of the patients keep their T cells for months and years. I mean, Emily still has those reprogrammed T cells in her body. And a lot of the patients who are 4, 5, 6, even 7 years out do. And so that's a large number of patients. But there are patients who, 20% or less, who lose their cells within a few months instead of keeping them for many years. And then there are other kinds of CAR T cell therapy that don't last nearly as long, that last 4, 5, 6 weeks, and then the cells are gone. And so we're just now figuring out lots of things. So the first question is, can you give the cells again if the effect wanes and you want to protect the patient for a little bit longer? And the answer is yes, you can. And we've done that in patients who have lost the cells quicker than we would like. So you can totally repeat the treatment safely in these patients. When you repeat the treatment under these circumstances, they don't have leukemia. All right, you're just trying to protect them, and there the side effects are nearly zero. It's a whole different experience for these patients. So repeating the treatment is not, it doesn't have significant risks associated with it at all. And then the other question you asked me is, how come Emily has her cells for all these years and other patients might only have their cells for a few months? And that's an area of really intensive research. We want to understand why T cells behave the way they do. Remember that this is not a drug where everybody gets the exact same thing, right? We're making this quote-unquote drug or this treatment out of the patient's very own T cells, and we're starting with the T cells that they have. And so what are the characteristics of these T cells that make them last longer and go the distance? Some people have marathon T cells, and some people have sprint T cells, and they go away a lot quicker. And that actually is one of the major areas of research focus in my own personal lab, and especially Dr. Barrett, who has been supported by the Emily Whitehead Foundation as well, is looking at these questions of why do T cells behave the way they do. But the short answer is we don't know. We have a lot to learn because this is a brand new field of medicine.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that, Doctor. I'll just now hand it over to Gary Peterson. Gary, you're on air.
Well, thank you, Priya. I appreciate it. And obviously for all of us, and I'm sure for Tom, this looks like a miracle, and possibly so for not only you and your family and daughter, but for many other people as well. So thank you so much for being part of that clinical trial. And Dr. Grupp, thank you so much for all that you've done as well. I understand that CAR T cell therapy focuses on, at least for leukemia, CD19 has some off-target impacts, and that the B cells, as a result, the patient needs a transfusion, and you said it was, I think it's some immunoglobulin. Can anything be done to correct this? Are there any other targets that are just specific
great,
to
great
leukemia,
question.
Which could
great
eliminate
question.
The off-target effect?
Yeah, so first off, if for other kinds of cancer, the target is going to be totally different, and so we wouldn't see this side effect except in B-cell type cancers, and that's leukemia and lymphoma. And so when you get away from this kind of disease, we're not going to see that side effect. There are two ways to get around this, and one way is you can use a short-acting form of the CAR T-cell. So the other CAR T-cell product that was also approved in 2017, a couple months after Kymriah was approved, that is made by a different company. It has a name that's called Yescarta, and that only lasts for a few weeks, and so there's no issue with long-term B-cell aplasia. But the issue for me is that this long-lasting property of the cells that we use is really what's allowing us not to take these patients to bone marrow transplant. That's actually what I do as a doc. I'm a bone marrow transplant doc, and I'm so excited that there are patients like Emily where we can just use this therapy and not transplant, so that long-lasting effect. Now, what can I do about it? Well, you could engineer, we haven't done this, but you could engineer a switch in the T cells so that you could turn them off. If you remove the reprogrammed or engineered T cells, then the natural B cells would come back and this need would go away. And so the reality is that we probably could erase these T cells from the patients. And after a few years, one of our central questions is that a good idea or not? And I would love, Tom, for you to comment, because this is an area that we talk about at every visit, what you think about the prospect of erasing the T cells.
Yeah, so Dr. Grupp has asked us quite often, and we've always told him that we have a normal child, and what we went through to get them in there, as parents, we would never make the decision to go back in there and erase them. And we said, when Emily gets older and becomes an adult after she's 18, if she would decide that it's time, that it's been long enough, and she would want to make that call, then that would have to be her own decision, because we just won't ever do it as parents. She lives a normal life, and other than that medicine that she gets every other week, we have a normal child.
And how exciting is that, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And we saw a lot of parents, that were in at the same time fighting just as hard as we were, and they lost their child, and they would give anything just for one more day with their children. So, we know how fortunate we are. And I've had talks with Dr. June, too, on his research, and he said maybe eventually they're going to have a switch that they can turn the T-cells off with a medicine and turn them back on if needed, so they wouldn't have to completely eliminate them. But that, again, that's coming in the future with more funding.
Well, that sounds great. One other question, Dr. Grupp. Recent long-term follow-up at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I believe they've been doing some research. They have found that the cytokine release syndrome occurs in 26% of patients, including one patient who died at the rate of severe neurotoxicity, and that was at 42%. So there was a CR in 83% of patients, but the median overall survival was just 12.9 months. So, and the median EFS, event-free, was 6.1 months. So the median follow-up time was 25 months. Is this your experience as well? And if so, this is a far cry from a cure, but what improvements do you see over this, and is yours different in some way?
So yes, it is, and no, that's not our experience. There are patients whose disease does come back after this kind of therapy, and one of the reasons it sometimes comes back is that the leukemia, which is really evil at doing stuff like this, learns to hide that target that you mentioned, which is CD19. And so in that situation, you can have awesome CAR T cells on the hunt, but they don't see the cancer anymore because CD19 is gone. And so that is the problem that we see in some patients. Our long-term experience is considerably better than the numbers that you just mentioned. 50 to 60% of our patients remain in remission 1-2 years out. That seems to be sustained beyond that, but then the number of patients, you know, as we go further and further back in time, we've treated smaller and smaller numbers of patients, including when you want to go to 6 years, there's only one human being on the planet with ALL that's 6 years out, and that's Emily. So 100% of one patient, that doesn't really mean much from a statistical point of view. And so the reality from our standpoint is that the long-lasting characteristic of the cells has allowed us to avoid transplant, and it does keep patients in remission for a long enough period of time that we are hopeful for the potential of cure. But that is 50 to 60% of the patients. It is not 100% of the patients, and so I just want to be clear about that. So we feel like the therapy has legs and that we're able to keep a reasonable number of the patients. And then you ask the question, how do you improve that? Well, my answer to that would be if some leukemia learns to hide, maybe what we need is a second target. And so we're actively working on clinical trials, and this is actually a major area that we're using the Emily Whitehead Foundation support to go after this. We're actively pursuing a second target, not to treat patients when their disease comes back, although that's how we would use it right now, but in the future to prevent that from ever happening. And we think that having two targets has the potential to bring that long-term disease control rate up from 50 to 60% to closer to 80%, which is a number that still isn't good enough, but is way better than what we have right now.
Well, yeah, exactly. And even a median overall survival of 12.9 months really beats anything that's really out there for late-stage myeloma, for example, and I would imagine similar for leukemia. I mean, new drugs are approved for 2 and 3 months improvement. So thank you very much, Doctor. And obviously, you're doing something right that other people have yet to figure out, so hopefully that will go and become common knowledge at some point in time. Priya, that's it for me.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. Jack, please go ahead with your questions.
Good morning, at least here in California. I really appreciate this phone call. I've learned an awful lot. I've been fortunate enough to meet the Whiteheads, a wonderful family, a few years ago in D.C., at one of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society Foundation meetings. So thank you for all you've done. Dr. Grupp, I have a question with respect to the cytokine release syndrome. Does it vary, or is it better or worse considering the disease that's being treated, or is it strictly related to the amount of cancer in that patient?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so this was a surprise to me. I had a definite prediction, and I was definitely wrong. I was thinking that it's all about your disease burden and not the kind of cancer you have, but it's not true. So it turns out that leukemia, like Emily had, is one disease that we treat with this, but lymphoma, which is a different kind of cancer, very related, but it works differently in your body. Lymphoma has a lower rate of this severe cytokine release syndrome. And without, again, I don't want to go over technical of this, but the thing is that leukemia is a disease where there are single cells floating all over your body, in your blood, in your bone marrow, sometimes in the spinal fluid. And when you put in the T cells, they find the cancer right away. And that's where that severe cytokine release syndrome comes from, is that a whole bunch of T cells killing a whole bunch of cancer in a very short period of time. Lymphoma is organized into balls of cancer, almost like a solid tumor. And there, the T cells have to work their way in, and they don't have access to all of the cancer the minute that you infuse the T cells. And that slower ramp up means that patients don't get as sick. So it seems to be very dependent on the kind of disease.
And you've answered most of my other questions. So the one thing we hear about every so often with respect to CAR T is that it may become a procedure where instead of taking T cells from the patient, that T cells or re-engineered CAR T cells can be produced from off the shelf. Do you envision that happening? And can you say a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So the off-the-shelf concept is under active development right now. I myself have treated a patient with an off-the-shelf CAR T-cell product, and we'll be working on another clinical trial where we're going to be trying these cells. The hope is that if you didn't have to make this product for every patient, it would be less expensive to make to basically take cells from a normal donor and make them into a dozen or a couple dozen products, and that would reduce the cost. And so if that turns out to be the case, that would be great, because that would obviously simplify the manufacturing problem. In this case, we have to collect cells from each individual patient. We have to send it to the facility, the Novartis facility, where they make the cells, and then they send it back, or we send them to our local facility as well. And so the issue, though, is that these cells are from another person, and the potential is for your body to say, hey, those cells don't belong there, and your own personal immune system reject those incoming cells. And then you wouldn't have that long-lasting capability. So if they can figure out a recipe where these cells last, where they have legs, where they're the marathon T cells that we were talking about, then this is a real additional step forward that might reduce cost and make the whole process a little bit simpler. If, on the other hand, the cells don't last very long, then it's not going to be as an exciting potential replacement. So right now, we don't have the sense of equivalence, but this is a hot topic. People are working very hard on it. There's a lot of interest in CAR T cells, which means this is a lot of investment in the area from a drug company standpoint. And so these are questions that are going to be answered in the next few years for sure.
Thank you very much, Dr. Grupp, and I'm so excited for your success, your family's success, Tom, and that's it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. We'll open it up for some QA from the listeners. Those of you who want to send in a question, please email them to priya@trialex.com, or you can also post the questions on the page that you're listening to this talk now, in the comment section. Dr. Grupp, we have received quite a few questions via email and some on the page as well, so I will quickly go through them. I will read them out so that you can answer as best possible. Phil wants to know, will CAR T cell therapy be considered for frontline treatment?
Oh, I love that question. So right now, the FDA-approved therapy is available for patients who either chemotherapy doesn't work at all, which is called refractory, or where the disease is actually come back not just once but twice, so two relapses. And we love the idea of being able to use this treatment earlier and save kids a lot of intensive chemotherapy. And so the Children's Oncology Group, which is the National Clinical Trials Group for Cancer in the United States, is starting a protocol this year that's going to pick patients very early in their treatment who have not experienced a relapse, but who we know have characteristics that say this is really bad ALL, bad leukemia, and we're going to try CAR T cells within a few months of diagnosis in these patients. And so that's pretty upfront, and it'll be a while before we have an answer on that clinical trial, but we're starting that research right now.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is from Amy. She wants to know, what happens if the cancer cells mutate to not express the antigen anymore that the T cells are targeted towards? Would the therapy then lose its function?
Yes, so it does. So the answer, that's what I was talking about before, that the thing that the T-cell C is a particular target called CD19. If CD19 goes away, which leukemia sometimes does, then you need an alternative target, and we have developed an alternative target, and that's one of the things that the Whitehead Foundation is helping us with. So that is our limitation. That is the thing that I believe is keeping us from an 80% success rate long term. Short term, we're over 90%, but the parents aren't coming to us for short term. They're coming to us for long term. And the way to get to long term 80% is to have that second target. So I think Amy's question is spot on.
Yeah. Thank you, Doctor. So I think we answered the question on whether a booster dose would be given if patients relapse. But we have a question from Nick who asks, what about children who have not relapsed? Would they need to take a booster dose sometime in future to maintain their cancer-free state?
Yes. So if the patient has their disease come back, but it is still CD19 positive, which is to say it still has the target, we could use these cells to get them back into remission, and we have. But the question that's being asked here is really about a true booster situation. So we have a well patient with no leukemia that we can detect, but a fear that the leukemia might come back because the T cells have disappeared. Yeah. And even though that's a small minority of our patients, we have absolutely done the booster approach. You know, it's hard to say whether it works or not, right? Because you're not actually treating leukemia that you can see, but it certainly is something that has not caused any harm.
Yeah. Thank you, Doctor. Kenny wants to know, is there an advisory board of researchers which will help guide a patient cancer support group to which immunotherapy platform is best matched with their particular tumor etiology? For example, CAR T therapy versus ACT versus CRISPR?
That's a tough question. The trouble is that there's so much, you know, innovation going on in the field right now that the usual benchmarks that we use as docs is long-term disease control. And for that to happen, you need to have been doing it for a number of years. I mean, you know, we're six years out from the first patient we ever treated. That's pretty early in some ways. And so the reality is that picking the right therapy when there are five different options is a challenge, and that's where your oncologist, I think, is a great help. And then, you know, as Tom mentioned, Carrie doing her research on this and also seeing what makes sense from a clinical trial perspective. You know, all of these new therapies are available at largely at large medical centers and on clinical trials. And so this is a real opportunity for families of children or for adults with cancer to say, hey, I'm willing to try something that's new. I want to see if there is some possibility for better outcomes, and the way I'm going to access that is a clinical trial. But there's no magic formula for three or four competing therapies that are very early in their development because we don't have that comparative data.
Thank you, Doctor. We have a question coming from Australia. Katie writes, our one-year-old child has ALL, MLL, and had a cord blood transplant recently. If she relapses, can you provide CAR T treatment for her? We noted that your trial is for three-year-old children only due to the limited availability of expanded T cells in younger children. What CAR T options do you have for younger infants like our daughter?
Well, what I'll start off by saying is that I hope that this particular patient stays in remission forever. And nothing I would say is intended to provide medical advice for an individual patient because, of course, I don't know any of the details. But I can answer the question in a general way. And I would say two things about that. First off, it is absolutely true that patients who are 2 years and younger, we have a lot more difficult time making CAR T cells from those patients than we do for patients who are older. And it really what ends up happening, there's been a lot of work done on this at CHOP, and Dr. Barrett is really leading this research. And what we've learned is that the very intensive chemotherapy that babies get for ALL really messes with their T cells. And even though the T cells grow back and are present in the patient's body at reasonable numbers, they don't work right. And this is very much an issue for babies. Now, in a patient, this is where it gets kind of complicated and interesting. When a patient has undergone a bone marrow transplant, then they don't have the baby T cells anymore. They have T cells that have never received chemotherapy. And in that situation, we're perfectly capable of making a CAR T cell product in a patient in that situation. But of course, the hope is that the transplant is successful and there's no need for CAR T cell therapy. The patient just remains in remission. That's what we all hope for.
Thank you, Doctor. We have a question from an anonymous person who writes in, any recent advances in the use of CAR T for T-cell lymphomas?
That is a really challenging question. So what I would say about that, so all the diseases we've been talking about using CAR T-cell therapy for is leukemia or lymphoma that's of B-cell origin. And now the question is about leukemia or lymphoma that is of T cell origin. And so here's this odd circumstance that we're in. We have CAR T cells, which are made from your own normal T cells, and we have a cancer which is derived from T cells. And the problem is we don't, without some very fancy genetic manipulation, which we're trying to figure out right now, there's no good way to keep the CAR T cells from killing each other, because they're also T cells at the same time that they're trying to kill the cancer. And so that problem of the CAR T cells killing each other because they're using a T cell tag is a challenge in the field right now. T cells, leukemia and lymphoma, when it relapses, is very hard to treat. I've had a wonderful parent who has been pushing for many years for us to make the kind of advances in T-cell therapy that we've made in B-cell-directed therapy. And I think that there's hope for this in the future, but there's some targets that we think that may not kill the CAR T-cells at the same time that we kill the cancer T-cells. But it is a challenge in terms of getting the T-cells not to recognize each other.
Thank you, Dr. Grupp. Neil writes in, can you share your perspective, please, on the CAR T program at Novartis versus the program at Glaxo and Legend Pharmaceutical? Any other players in this space that you could highlight for us?
Full disclosure, the product that I have, or the CAR T cell approach that I have been working personally to investigate for the past decade is the one that was licensed to Novartis, which is called Kymriah. The other major product that's available right now is that Yescarta product. The difference between the two is that one tends to last longer, which is the one that we've been working with, Kymriah, and one tends to go away very quickly, which is the Yescarta product. Now, in leukemia patients, there is a clear advantage to keeping the cells longer, so I think it's really important. In lymphoma patients, it may be that just having these cells for 6 to 8 to 10 weeks may be long enough, and there may not be as obvious a difference. So it's a little bit hard to tell the answer to that right now. And so I think the platforms differ, the diseases differ, and the applicability differs. And then, of course, I have the most experience with the product that lasts the longest. Now, there are lots of other companies. I just want to jump in and say one more thing. And there are lots of other companies that are developing a whole group of different approaches. And so the answer to this question is in 2 years is going to be completely different, I think.
Thank you, Dr. Grubb. We have one last question from Mike, and this is on multiple myeloma. How is this therapy being conducted to address multiple myeloma? Are they targeting BCMA, CD38, or CD19, or a combination of these targets, or all of them?
So a lot of that. I'm a pediatrician. I don't treat patients with myeloma, but I have been very excited by the results that I've seen with a specific target, which is the first one mentioned by that person, which is BCMA. And BCMA is a great target for myeloma, and we're definitely seeing significant short-term results in patients with bad myeloma with BCMA. And so we don't have enough follow-up to say if these are long-lived responses. We just doesn't mean that I don't think they are. It just means we haven't followed the patients long enough because it's brand new. But for me, as a researcher in the CAR T-cell field, to see something other than CD19 working this well is incredibly exciting. CD38 is being approached by a drug, but it's also being approached by CAR T-cells, and I bet in the next year or two we're going to see some data on CD38. I don't want to get, again, I could get super technical about this. CD19 shouldn't work in myeloma because of the way that myeloma works, but it does occasionally work, and when it works amazingly well, but it would be probably work in a very small minority of cases. So for me right now, the most interesting shot on goal in myeloma, which is a disease where there are a lot of therapeutic options but no cures at all, is really the BCMA CAR.
Thank you, Dr. Grubb. We have a comment that has just come in on our page, and this is for you and the team at CHOP. The parent says, thank you, Dr. Grubb and the team at CHOP. Our daughter is 3 months post-CAR T at CHOP and thriving. Our family is so grateful to all of you.
Well, thank you very much for that, and it's our fondest hope for each of our patients that those responses just go on.
Dr. Grubb, this has been a great discussion. CAR T cell therapy is a breakthrough treatment for cancer. And thank you so much for your time and sharing all this information with us. We're almost at the end of an hour. And thank you for all the great work that you're doing, saving so many lives. Tom, thank you so much. Wishing Emily and your family the very best. Gary and Jack, thanks for the great questions. Also want to thank University of Pennsylvania and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the wonderful audience. This talk will be made available on curetalks.com. Please visit our website for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone. Have a great evening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for giving us new last chance.